So is it fair then to call people who speak Afrikaans, Afrikaners? I find myself getting into trouble now and then with friends who I know are Afrikaans speakers. When I call them Afrikaners, they say, don't call me an Afrikaner. Well, I mean, is there a difference between an Afrikaans speaker and an Afrikaner?
Yes and no. I think the term Afrikaner still has too much of a loaded political meaning.
Hello again, I'm Peter Bruce and welcome back to Podcasts from the Edge, my weekly attempt to ease or at least reduce my constant anxiety about not knowing anything. I find ignorance tolerable if it's out in the open, and Podcasts from the Edge is my attempt to educate myself. And I find the older I get, the less interested I am in the future of South Africa and the more interested I am in the country as it was when I was a boy. So I've been reading a bit and thoroughly enjoying this history that's been produced at a rapid pace by my friend and fellow former newspaper editor, Richard Stein. And it was while reading his biography of General Louis Botha, I realized reading the book that I have no idea, for instance, what language the Boer fighters were using as they fought and frightened the life out of the British Empire. So I began to cast around for somebody to talk to about Afrikaans and Afrikaners, if it turns out that there are such people. Around, and my father's most mentioned name was that of Teuns Eloff, a Renaissance man of such measure that I'm embarrassed to even try and sum up his life. He's been a priest and student leader, a university vice chancellor, author, a diplomat who kept all sides talking to each other during the peace process that gave us our democracy. He was one of the delegation of Afrikaans speaking leaders who met the ANC leadership in Senegal in 1987. He's run the F.W. de Klerk Foundation and he's now chairman of Astral Foods, the major poultry producer, and chairman of the Duckbrick Trust, a nearly 68-year-old fund that has grown out of the newspaper industry and which now promotes Afrikaans culture and language. So, Teuns, thank you so much for joining me and making time to talk. I want to ask you about the history of the language, but given that we are in South Africa and interested in current affairs, they might come up as well. But first things first. The first policy position adopted by the new DA leadership has been to announce a campaign for the return of Afrikaans as a medium of instruction or education at Stellenbosch University. Do you support that, and do you know why it was taken away?
Peter, thank you very much for the privilege. I'm not sure that I know the guy you described, but I'll take some of it. Look, it's a long story, but it boils down to the following, that in Section 29.2 of our Constitution, the right tongue language tradition is acknowledged. And on that basis, Afrikaans public schools and universities who had Afrikaans as tuition language based their reason for existence on. There was a clash between equality and access on the one hand of especially black students and learners and the language rights on the other hand. And unfortunately, our constitutional court in every single case so far has taken a decision to give preference to equality and access at the cost of Afrikaans as tuition. So at the moment, there is literally only one out of 36 campuses in our country of university campuses where you can still get a degree in Afrikaans, not in the language, not in the subject Afrikaans, but through the tuition of Afrikaans, and that is Potchefstroom campus of the Northwest University. At Stellenbosch University, it's been watered down over a long period of time to the advantage of English, and sometimes under the guise of so-called multilingualism. The fact is that at the moment, Afrikaans is dwindling at Stellenbosch University, and that is why I think the DA saw this as an opportunity to stake sort of a claim, a language claim. Obviously, there are some political considerations in the Western Cape. You know, The majority of Afrikaans speakers in South Africa are not white today. About 60%, 57% to be exact, are so-called coloureds or brown people, and only a minority are white. And I think that is part of the decision of the DA to work for that. My own view is that it's not possible to unscramble that egg. At Potchefstroom, you may have a chance, but even there, demographic and other political considerations and the ideology of the ANC government has made it almost impossible to let Afrikaans survive as a language of higher education. With the schools, it's slightly better at the moment still. There are, of the 24,000 odd schools we have in South Africa, 1,250 have Afrikaans as a single medium of instruction. About another 1,200 have Afrikaans and English as a dual medium of instruction, but most of those schools are under pressure to become English only, and so Afrikaans is under huge pressure in our education system.
Say, Lord Milner would have been very pleased. When you did meet the ANC in Senegal in 1987, Tiens, did the issue of language come up at all?
Only in passing. You know, we were talking about the sort of bigger picture things of politics, to a lesser extent economics. It was more about, do we have a constitution, will there be a Bill of Rights and things like that. I think it was taken for granted that there would be a Bill of Rights and that there would be certain rights, language and cultural rights. And indeed, those rights have been set into the constitution of 1996. The problem is that the race transformation ideology of the ruling party have made it impossible for minorities to keep some of those rights. I think one of the other things is that in the constitution it says in the first chapter that the state has a specific duty to develop the other languages to the same parity. They should have parity of esteem. And that's one of the things that hasn't been done in the New South Africa. So there's a sort of de facto move, almost a default move, towards English as the only language everywhere. And that's, I think, not only to the detriment of Afrikaans, but also to isiXhosa and Setswana and Pedi and all the others.
We'll come back to that in a minute, because obviously Afrikaans has developed to the extent that it is an academic language as well. But I wanted to ask you, Tiens, about how Afrikaans first started being spoken in South Africa. I mean, you know, the Dutch arrived, presumably speaking Dutch. The what we like to call the French Huguenots, who were Protestant French from a Dutch-speaking part of the country, near Flanders, I think, arrived speaking more or less Dutch. I guess the question is, to what problem was the creation of the Afrikaans language a solution?
The interesting thing, Peter, is that the aim of language is to communicate and to understand one another, and that is exactly why Afrikaans was created. But this creation process was a long, long process. And for that, I need to take you back slightly. Obviously, even before that bad guy, according to Jacob Zuma, Jan van Riebeek, came to the Cape to set up a small station there, for giving water and provisions to passing ships. There had already been a number of Portuguese seafarers who landed on the west coast near Mossel Bay and who had contact with the local koi. The koi was the other part of the koi sun, so the sun were more the hunters, gatherers, while the koi were farmers who had cattle and sheep. And to understand each other, the Portuguese had to start learning some words from the koi, but it has been proven that the koi could learn Portuguese easier than the Portuguese could learn koi. So that was the first contact. And then obviously when the Dutch came in 1652, that contact went broader and deeper. So over the 150 years that the Dutch controlled the Cape, Dutch became the language spoken there, but it underwent significant changes. It became different from the Dutch spoken in the Netherlands. And the influences on that language and how Afrikaans is a language that has a huge diversity in it is that you had influences from the Khoi. Their interaction with the Dutch settlers made them to speak and make some words that they could understand each other. Then early or late in the 17th century, the slave trade also became strong in the Cape. Slaves were imported from the East, from Malaysia and other places, and the slaves also had an input into that. And one of the first, interestingly enough, the first written Afrikaans or call it Afrikaans Dutch, was as early as 1750, when in Muslim Afrikaans, there was in Arabic script, some Afrikaans was written. So what happened here is that you had a diversity of people. You mentioned the French Huguenots. There was Germans. There were the British settlers, but mostly the Germans, the French, and the Dutch, who had to interact with the local population, the Khoi, and obviously with the slaves. And so what happened is that the Dutch became more popular to speak, and as it was called, slightly common, a more common form of Dutch. And it was called Cape Dutch, basically. And over the 150 years, it became spoken by more and more people. And as they moved inland, you know, to farm or to hunt, they took that with them. And so the Dutch that was spoken in the court or in the castle by the officials remained closer to the Netherlands Dutch. But the Dutch spoken in the rural areas where slaves interacted, where the Khoi interacted with the farmers, became much more of an Afrikaans. Obviously, the academics have done a lot of research about this, but it seems that as early as 1707, one of the Dutch settlers, Hendrik Bibo, had this famous pronunciation in a court of law when he was taken to court because he didn't pay taxes. He said, "Ik ben een Afrikaner." I am an African, Afrikaner actually. And but so over time, over the 150 years, the Dutch became not yet Afrikaans as we know today, obviously, but a bastard form of Dutch, which was quite different from what was spoken, and that was a hybrid language, and that's why Afrikaners today have a new sense, almost a new awakening, that Afrikaans is not just the European language; it's a mixture of European words, Khoi words, and Malay or slave words from the East. So in that sense, it's really a creation of Africa. Now, what happened after, as our country and Africa, as it's always it's often happened, is that the British annexed the Cape, first time in 1795, then afterwards 3 years the Dutch got it back, but in 1806 the British finally got there, and they were governors then of the Cape. And for the next 110 years, until 1910, the British influence was very strong. And as the Brits do everywhere they go in the world, they anglicize everything that walks or doesn't walk. And so they were immediately in Cape Town and surroundings. There was a strong anglicization project by Lord Charles Somerset. And you know, you see Cradock and Caledon. The towns that we have were all named after English or British governors. And so the Dutch then, or the Afrikaans, call it the Afrikaans Dutch speaking people, were far further away from Cape Town. But as they moved closer inland, that language went with them. And at that time, you had four specific types of Afrikaans. There was the Muslim Afrikaans, which was spoken in Cape Town, mostly obviously by Muslims. There was the Khoi Afrikaans, which was spoken by Khoi working on farms or trading with farmers. There was the farmer Afrikaans, those guys who were Freeburgers or Freiburgers. And then you had on the closer in the Karoo, today's Karoo, you have the border Afrikaans, people who had contact with more with Khoi. And people are saying that border Afrikaans, really together with some other Orange River Afrikaans, Griqua Afrikaans, became the sort of foundation for standard Afrikaans as we know today.
When was it first codified? When was it written down? There must have been the production of a dictionary at some stage or a text.
Yes, in the middle 80s, 1850, 60, you already had some script, letters in newspapers here and there, a small little magazine. But it was only in the early 20th century that there was the codification, and there was a whole move to codify and decide, you know, what is Afrikaans. When you asked me to come onto the program, I had to do a bit of research just to refresh my memory. And what I realized is that Afrikaans actually had two antagonists. The one was English, obviously, but the other one was Dutch, because there were some people, Dutch-speaking people, but also people who had been long living in South Africa, who thought that we should keep Dutch because it was a more international language than this new bastard language. So Afrikaans had to overcome two foes to become codified. And that was brought about by two or three people differ about whether there was two or three taalbewegings, language movements, the one as early as 1875. Now, the irony here, and this is a tragic history of Afrikaans, is that in 1875, a guy called Arnoldus Ponnefus had a strong campaign to have the Bible translated from Dutch into Afrikaans so that colored people, as he called them, could understand the Bible better. They couldn't understand this high Dutch that the Bible was written in. Unfortunately, after him, the move went more to nationalism and white Afrikaners. So when the Bible was eventually translated, starting to be translated in the late 19th century, and it was completed in 1933, Afrikaans was declared almost a white language, even though it had the input and the words from a myriad of other sources. And because Afrikaans and nationalism then became synonymous. And although colored people still spoke Afrikaans, the white people almost annexed it.
Yes. So is it fair then to call people who speak Afrikaans Afrikaners? I find myself getting into trouble now and then with friends who I know are Afrikaans speakers. When I call them Afrikaners, they say, don't call me an Afrikaner. Well, I mean, is there a difference between an Afrikaans speaker and an Afrikaner?
Yes and no. I think the term Afrikaner still has too much of a loaded political meaning. Colored people, so-called colored people, brown people as we say in Afrikaans, have a very strong sense that they are Afrikaans speakers, but they are not in the political sense of the word or the nationalist sense of the word Afrikaners. I am both. I am an Afrikaner, but I also feel a very strong affinity to everyone, whatever color, also speak Afrikaans. So, you know, for me, it's sort of concentric circles. Culturally and history-wise, I'm an Afrikaner, and I don't want to be anything else. But I'm also wider, in a wider sense of the word, an Afrikaans speaker. In Afrikaans, we would say Afrikaans spreken. And I think many, many, especially of colored people, but some white Afrikaans speakers would say, I'm not an Afrikaner because that's too much of a political loaded term linked to apartheid. But I think it's becoming less so, and I think more and more people say, look, I'm an Afrikaner and I'm okay with that. I remember when I was a student in the 1970s, I didn't want to be called an Afrikaner. I said I'm a South African, and it was only after, you know, we had our constitution, and where for Afrikaans there was a place in the constitution, that I started again calling myself an Afrikaner.
There was many attempts, and they started a long time ago, to define what an Afrikaner was. And there was a magazine or a newspaper in the 1850s, I think it was, called Die Zuid-Afrikaan. It was a Dutch publication, but it defined Afrikaners as those who were the English or Dutch who inhabit the land and were bound by duty and interest to further the well-being of their country. Obviously, that didn't stick. How are Afrikaners able now to assert themselves as a culture? I mean, a lot of Afrikaans-speaking people I know are having tremendous amount of fun in the new South Africa. They are relieved of the burden of being the bad guys. And I just wonder whether the culture is changing with it as well. You know, I'm like most English people. I just speak English, and I get spoken back to me. And I sometimes am ashamed of myself for not paying the right sort of respect to other South Africans or whatever language they might speak, without asking if it's okay, you know, to speak to them in my language. It's a difficult thing.
Look, you know, I think these days many Afrikaners or Afrikaans speakers are relieved, as you say, that the burden of apartheid has been left behind. Obviously, we're reminded every now and then of that by the likes of Julius Malema and others, which I think they use race and that more to create problems than try to build a nation. I think they are at the moment, if I can analyze the Afrikaans speakers a bit, you have obviously the one divide, not a divide, but the one distinction is white Afrikaans speakers and then brown Afrikaans speakers, and there are about 700,000 black Afrikaans speakers, the census showed a while ago. So they are literally Africans who speak Afrikaans as their own language. Amongst the white Afrikaans speakers, you probably have in the northern parts of the country, most of them would call themselves Afrikaners. They would often belong to AfriForum or Solidarity, not all of them, but quite a number of them. You have in the southern parts, you have the Afrikaners who would not identify with Solidarity or AfriForum, although sometimes I think they did what the English voters did during the National Party. They blamed the National Party, but pray to God that they stayed in government. And so you've got different Afrikaners, and Herman Gilemeer, renowned historian, has this tongue-in-cheek description. He said during the days of the Boer War, end of 19th century, you had the Republicans in the north who said, "We are not subjects of anyone, we are burghers, we are citizens of a republic." Whereas the Cape Afrikaners said, we are subjects, loyal subjects of Her Majesty the Queen. And to some extent, you still have that distinction that many of the southern Afrikaners or Afrikaans speakers are loyal subjects of the governing party, whereas the guys in the north are slightly more rebellious and want to do their own thing. It's a generalization, but you get the point.
But does it fit still? Because in a way, it you know, that might mirror the time of the Boer War. But if you see today, you know, a kind of increasing rebelliousness among Afrikaans-speaking people. It doesn't show itself. Nobody's riding around the country on horseback shooting people. But,
no. But
you know, AfriForum is very active. It's just built itself a university. Afrikaners have never really been as united as people would like to portray them sometimes as having been. But I just wonder whether there's a new divide in amongst Afrikaans speakers now.
Yes. Look, I would say that 98-99% of all Afrikaners, white Afrikaans speaking Afrikaners, are happy with the constitution, don't want to go anywhere else. Some of them do immigrate though, but they don't want a new homeland. They don't want to go and live in Orania. They're quite happy if others want to go there, they're happy, but we're not going there. So I think, you know, constitutionally speaking, they accept the constitution, they're happy that apartheid is gone. What concerns them are two sets of factors. The one set of factors is a concern for everyone in the country, and that would be crime, you know, safety, education standards, living standards, the economy, et cetera, et cetera. That's not new. That's not typical of Afrikaners. But then you come to things like language and cultural areas and so on, and especially the way the Afrikaans language has been taken out of universities and increasingly under pressure in schools, and that puts them, you know, on their feet, their back feet, and they say, well, you know, we've had this wonderful transition with the new constitution. And we're very happy with that, and we're doing our bit, we're creating jobs, we're, you know, active in the economy. But more and more, what we've strived for, that we got written into the constitution by a consensus, also by the ANC, is dwindled down, is watered down in terms of whether we can have even non-racial schools using Afrikaans as language. And as I said, unfortunately, the courts, especially the Constitutional Court, has not clouded itself in glory in that regard.
Do you think they have a point? I mean, do you think the people that are irritated by this have a right to be irritated or annoyed or upset?
I do think so, yes. But because what is happening, for instance, typically in Gauteng with the very notorious Mr. Panyasa Lesufi, he hasn't built 10% of the schools that he had a budget for and should have built in the last 5 years. So what happens in the beginning of the year is that he has too many children learners to place. And so he says, look, we must place them everywhere. And the moment you have 20 or 30 or 40 learners who can't speak Afrikaans in Afrikaans school, you must have double medium language. And we've seen historically the last 10 years that within 5 years, a double medium school, unless you are a Grey or a Paul Roos, where they have a specific structured way to do things, those schools become English only. And so, yes, I do think in that regard they have a point. It's not that they don't want any other learners or don't want any non-Afrikaans learners in their schools. That's not the point. The point is that the government has a responsibility. We all pay taxes for them to build enough schools for all the population. And I feel strongly personally that the government should listen to the international research in this regard, and we should have mother tongue tuition in schools up to grade 6 or even 8, because that's what the international research shows. And I think,
are we even capable of that?
Well, it's supposed to go to grade 3 now, but if we're not capable, Peter, in the urban areas, you now have second and perhaps even third generation Black South Africans who speak English. They're fine. They're English. The problem is that we still have more than 40%, 45%, by last count, of our learners are in rural areas, and they don't speak proper English. They don't speak English well. And I have a theory that's perhaps slightly more than a theory, that even our bad performance in maths in our schools is a language problem, not a maths problem. It's been shown, if you don't understand the language properly, can't speak it, if you're forced to speak it too early, then you can't understand maths, you can't do maths. So, yes, I do think Afrikaners have a point. And it's interesting enough, in this regard, white Afrikaners and brown Afrikaans speakers have common cause. And they're moving closer to each other, because in the Cape, where most of the brown Afrikaans speakers are, more and more schools are moving also to English and leaving them high and dry. Especially, again, it's the rural areas where browns, in the Western Cape, at the West Coast and so on, where they are forced here and there, where the English, the Afrikaans schools are becoming double medium and they're English only, where they don't have any place to go. And that puts them at a disadvantage. To give you one little statistic, of Afrikaans-speaking brown learners, only 2.5% gain access to university. 2.5%. Now, that is, I mean, Indians are about 70%. Whites are, I think, still around 50%. Africans are now coming up between 30 and 40%. And colored Afrikaans pupils are only 2.5%. And it's often a quality issue, but it's also a language issue.
And the solution is obviously to govern better. But why does it have no political expression, this sort of absence of opportunity? I mean, why is it, I understand that the Freedom Front Plus is a largely Afrikaans party, but it doesn't campaign as an Afrikaans party. It's strangely muted in that respect, I find. Yeah. Why is there not a... Well, why is this not translated into a political movement?
I must say, I don't know. I'm thinking very hard while you're asking the question. I do think that civil rights organizations such as AfriForum has made strides in this regard. Now, perhaps I should just tell the listeners that the overarching, or call it the federal structure, is the Solidarity Movement. They're the overarching, and then they've got... Under Solidarity Movement, you've got the Solidarity Trade Union, typical trade union. You've got AfriForum, you've got Marula Media, you've got Academia, which is the university, you've got Soltech, which is the technical college. That's the one you spoke about earlier. So I think AfriForum, as a civil rights arm of the solidarity movement, have done a lot about this in the past, but they're also doing other things. They're also working with municipalities to restore water and sewage facilities to all communities, as white communities. But they are activists, and so often people don't like their style, they don't like what they do. But I think that would be the closest to a political movement. I think the problem basically is numbers. That the Afrikaners in numbers are now, I would say, at about 4 million and dwindling because of immigration mostly. Colored Afrikaans speakers are about, I would say, 6 or 7 million, so more than those. But not all of them are mobilizable, if I can use the word, for a cause such as Afrikaans. More and more we find that they are at a local level. They can get very active, activist about if
Afrikaans. Is there a noticeable immigration of Afrikaans speakers?
I don't think more than English, white English speakers. But yes, because both of those groups have small numbers. I would guess that English-speaking white South Africans would now be about 2.5 million, if that much. So, those are the people who have the means to immigrate. Colored Afrikaans speakers will, in very rare cases, immigrate. And obviously, April this year was the first time on an absolute basis where more Africans, more black South Africans, immigrated than white South Africans.
Is it possible to build a private university in South Africa? I mean, is it possible for let's say AfriForum or any group, the Dachbrug Trust, which you are chairman of, to build a university and to say, look, we're building this to teach people in Afrikaans. It's an academic language. You can become a doctor or a lawyer or a brain surgeon in Afrikaans. Would the government stop you?
No. In actual fact, Solidarity has built Soltech, which is a technical college, about 12 years ago, if I'm right. The new building that I think you refer to is the building of Soltech, so it's a technical college, and they've not had any problems from government in terms of curriculum and things like that. In actual fact, I know that Bladen Zamande had a long discussion with them the other day about how can they help place other technical colleges graduates because they don't seem to get jobs. Solidarity is next, is parallel to that, busy running Academia, which is a private Afrikaans institution. Up to the end of this year, it would only be on a distance learning basis, but from next year, it will take in residential students. So they're hiring at the moment a campus in Centurion. I think they're looking at, they already have about 1,000 distance students, and they're looking at about 500 for the first intake. They've got 5 faculties, if I'm right. And they're looking to build in Pretoria East a new campus for Academia, which will be ready by 2025. Because it's a huge undertaking. It's more than R1 billion. So, yes, the answer is yes, it can be done. And the government can't stop you and won't stop you unless they have, some issues with curriculum. But so far, both Soltech and Academia told me that they've not had good cooperation from the civil servants, because also it's for the civil servants mostly it's not a political issue. I think what might be an issue is if they had they placed qualifications on access in terms of race, because race is a prohibited factor in terms of discrimination, whereas language is not. And I know they're working very hard to make sure that they have bursaries also for colored Afrikaans-speaking students. With regard to schools, Afrikaans schools, we've got some strong public schools still in Afrikaans, but one of the trusts I'm chairing is the Trust for Afrikaans Education, and we started in August last year a private company called the MOS Initiative. MOS stands for Moedertaal en Onafhankelijke Skole, so it's basically independent group. And we, as a parallel strategy to good Afrikaans public schools, are starting to build and run Afrikaans independent schools on a non-racial basis. And I'm very excited. It's very small, but it's going to be something for the future, and that would also just show that the Constitution does allow that for Afrikaans speakers, and we're very happy that we have both brown and white Afrikaans speakers fully behind this initiative.
I remember seeing a press release from Astral Foods in about June or July. You had contracted COVID-19, and they were informing the stock market, I guess, or shareholders. And this was a couple of months after you had begged the government publicly to stop the lockdown. How do you think, in retrospect, we have managed this pandemic in South Africa?
Look, let me first put the context right before I give you my answer. I think what happened, not only in South Africa, but elsewhere in the world, is that although people must concede that this is a flu strain, it always had been a different one, no special one. And I think there was so little known about this that governments and politicians just didn't know what to do and what would be the end. I mean, it could have been much worse, and I think many projections were much worse, because we didn't know. And I think that's why most governments, with the exception of Trump in America and perhaps the guy in Brazil, acted with overly cautious, if you wish. And so I would say that although I would thought and I wrote that we should now move to a lesser form of lockdown at that point, that although we probably had a lockdown for 6 weeks or 8 weeks too long, and perhaps too severe, we could have lessened it earlier. I understand that you know, government could always say, look, we can rebuild the economy, but we can't get people's lives back. So I think they erred on the side of caution. I would give President Ramaphosa, you know, overall a 7 out of 10 for his management of this. He loses 3 because it was too long. But I think, you know, that was sort of the whole world, with a few notable exceptions, acted that way. So but I think now we must really, you know, build the economy and make sure that we don't. And I must say, I don't envy the president, because I think, for instance, he made a good point, made a good decision when they locked down Nelson Mandela Bay, which is a specific area, and there's a problem, and the hospitals are not well run there.
Yes.
I'm sure Alan Windey said to him, Mr. President, we can't afford to lose all the tourists this season. Let me handle this. And if I can't handle it, you can step in. And that's why Alan Windey has announced, I think, a 3-point plan, and he's asked for people to adhere. So, I Cyril was wise there, and I'm happy with that. So I'm not too critical on him. Others maybe thought it shouldn't have been done at all. I think you couldn't have expected anything else, but perhaps it was a little bit long.
Yeah. And then lastly, just the future of the ANC, and it's worth talking about simply because there's no other obvious possible governing party even on the horizon. This is a dysfunctional unit in almost every conceivable way. How do we survive the ANC? You know, it's almost impossible to put it under pressure because the numbers just aren't there. How does the country get past these people, you know, and their particular problems and their particular way of approaching contradictions and difficulties? The ANC is a law unto itself. The country is governed by the ANC, not by the government. And if you do business with the government, you're doing business with the party. It's insane.
Look, I'm not Clem Sunter, but I've developed 3 sort of basic scenarios, more short-term than 20 years. And the one is that Cyril wins and manages to get more investment, roots out the corruption in a planned way, and that we turn things around, and that Cyril will be re-elected for the second term. He would go until 2027, and then there will be younger people to take over, and we would have a 3-4, perhaps a 5% growth rate. That's the best case scenario.
Yeah, that's the wildly optimistic one.
Yeah, no, true. The worst case scenario is that ACE doesn't go away. He's charged as he has been, but he's not found guilty because of a lack of evidence, because he's put pressure on all the witnesses not to testify against him. At the next elective conference, they get rid of Cyril, and ACE becomes president. And ACE would then probably govern until 2029, after which the ANC will be kicked out because the country would be in chaos, or they would have a dictatorship. So that's the worst case scenario. The middle one, which is probably the more realistic one, is that Cyril has some success in terms of the economy. He used the private partnership growth initiative to work around the uselessness of government departments and municipalities and provincial governments, and he gets some things done. But ACE remains, and there's the schism in the ANC, and that would only then come to a head in 2024, or actually 2022, sorry, when the elective conference happens. And it's 50-50 whether Cyril then makes it because he's made some progress, or whether the likes of ACE or Supramamupela or one of those guys come in. In any case, you've asked me the question, how do we get rid of them? You and I have no influence, unfortunately. The people in the ANC would have to sort this out. And there are people, that are very concerned. And I think it would be good for us, the likes of us, to talk to them and to give them encouragement and give them wisdom. But in the end, either the ANC will heal itself, but it won't happen automatically, or it would be so bad that there would be some kind of coalition opposition taking over in either 2024, which is unlikely, but definitely 2029. There has been some talk, though, about reviving the concept of a UDF. So instead of, and that's premised on the fact that if the parliament agrees to the and passes the legislation that the courts, the constitutional court put on the table, that individual candidates should be able to stand in the national election. Yes. If that is by 2024, it could be that a new UDF, not necessarily the name, could, as a broad front of civic organizations, put in place a number of candidates from across party political lines and become a meaningful opposition. Now, this is just talk, it's sort of dinner talk, but it is a possibility, because then you could actually get all the good ANC guys to say, okay, we're not fighting the ANC inside the ANC, we're fighting it from outside as the UDF will be a part of it from outside. And that's a possibility, but I'm at the moment we're in a long, hard struggle centered on corruption. One of my own personal pet problems, Peter, is the lack of capacity in the civil service, and especially at municipality level. Yeah. It is just indescribable how many of the municipalities in the rural areas look. I'm not talking Western Cape. I'm talking, north of that. And someone said the other day that in 5 years' time, small towns would be labor camps, where people just live and they would try to go elsewhere for work because there's no economy left, and that's absolutely the local government. What it's worth, I'm not emigrating, I'm not going anywhere. I think it's an exciting country, but we've got a bit of work to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thanks, TNC Lof. I wish I could talk to you forever. Thank you so much for your time, and to people fortunate enough to have heard this conversation, thank you too. And please stay with Podcasts from the Edge. This is all new to me, so please forgive the ums and the ahs. I'll be back with another interesting guest next week with one final edition before the holidays, and I really hope you can join me.